My name is Kay Gray, and I'm a member of Al-Anon. Hi, y'all. I am absolutely thrilled to be here. It's an honor and a privilege to be able to do anything for the Al-Anon Fellowship or AA Fellowship either. And it's just such an honor to get to come to your 24th State Al-Anon Conference. It's in a beautiful setting. I mean, what could be wrong with this? It's just absolutely gorgeous. I love your theme. I just absolutely love the colors of our heart. You know, Bill said that the common bond is that our language of the heart, and that we all are just brothers and sisters in this fellowship. I want to thank that committee for asking me to come and for Stephanie making that phone call. I already have a little resentment, though. Last night, when Larsine was talking, which, by the way, thank you, Larsine, that was wonderful, she said that Stephanie had written her 12 letters. I went back to my room. I have all of my letters with me. Four. Just four. But I just want to say that I absolutely have not felt that I have missed a thing. I had great communication with Stephanie throughout the time, from the time she called me, and many calls from Lois, and we did talk back and forth a number of times. And when I got off that plane yesterday, it was just like old friends. And I don't know where else you can go in this world and find that. And I am so grateful. I did not have that before I got here, but I've had it since I've been here. And if that hasn't happened for you yet, stay close, because it will. I just wanted to thank Lois and Vicki for squaring me around yesterday. Lois picked me up, and then we hooked up with Vicki, and we laughed and enjoyed the ride all the way up here. I enjoyed hearing Mickey last night. You know, a fellow Texan's always good to have around, and of course we have Bob to look forward to, and Brittany and the other speakers, AJ, and I'm looking forward to hearing them too. I was so surprised yesterday when we walked in the registration, and my friend Bob and Juanita were there. I was not expecting to see them, and it's always such a joy to do that. I'm from Dallas, and I go have a home group. I want you to know that. My home group is the Big Book Group in Dallas, Texas, and we meet on Monday, Thursday, and Saturday. If you're ever in the Dallas area, I'm listed in the telephone book. It's under Joe and Kay Gray. Please give me a call, and I'd love to take you to an Al-Anon meeting, and we'll do one of the things that we like to do best in Texas, and that's eat, too. So you just are always welcome. I love my home group, and I think that it is so important that I have a home group where I can do service and that I suit up and show up and sometimes even shut up. And sit in those meetings with the women and men that I sit with week after week. I'm very active in Al-Anon, and I've been on committees and done service work, and of course the honor and privilege of being able to sponsor has been just an absolute highlight and joy of my life, and to be sponsored. I'm sponsored by a beautiful Al-Anon woman that lives in Denver, Colorado now, and we were just talking about her a little while ago with the taper, and she and her husband have been so instrumental in my life. You know, I was just born in a regular home where there was alcoholism, just your average garden variety alcoholism. I guess I didn't know that. I didn't know that until I walked into the doors of Al-Anon in November the 5th, 1986. But I certainly began to have problems with alcoholism at an early age. I didn't know that either. I didn't know that it was bothering me, but it was. I better do water right now. I have a mother and father, and I have a brother 11 years older than I am, and I was raised like an only child. I was a very loved child, and I knew that, but there was something that went on in my house that I couldn't feel that love all the time. I couldn't figure out why people that told me they loved me and showed me that they loved me did the things that they did. My family got together a lot. I'm from a big family that likes to gather for birthdays and Thanksgivings and Christmases, and boy, oh boy, that was the time. That was really the time. We were over at my aunt's and uncle's house one time when I was about 6 years old, and this is really the first time I remember that my dad's drinking bothered me. They were doing what they always do, playing cards and playing dominoes, and the men were in one room laughing and telling jokes, and I always wanted to be in there where that was going on, and the women were in the kitchen. Now, they weren't laughing and telling jokes, they were muttering and complaining and worrying about dinner. You know, there's just something about if you can feed the alcoholic, they'll quit drinking. Have y'all heard that? Wrong. This particular night, they were hurrying to get dinner on the table because they wanted the guys to stop drinking. And they did come to the table, and they didn't stop drinking. And that I knew that wasn't a surprise. They did that all the time. But my mother began to do something that she did a lot, and that was tell my dad it was time to go. He'd had too much to drink. He didn't agree with her. They didn't agree on much. And he continued to laugh and joke with the uncles. And pretty soon, after her coming to him many times and saying, let's go, repetitively, he just kind of, he didn't blow up, but he got up, and you knew that we were ready to go. And we got in the car, and we lived about 30 miles north of Dallas at that time. And on the way, I got in the back seat, and I can remember laying down in that back seat and praying to that God that I understood, or of my understanding then. I was raised in church, and what was going to happen next, I knew that I was going to need prayers for, because my dad drove fast. I don't know if you've ever been in a car with an alcoholic. You know, we just get in a car with someone's drunk and never even think about getting out, never even think about getting in either. But we got in the car with him, and he took off. And I'd like to tell you that I was just a very precocious and very bright child, that I looked over the back seat of that car and recognized that speedometer was going all the way over to 120. That's how long ago it was. It had 120 on the speedometer. And but what was happening in that front seat was that my mom's mouth just never closed. You know, for many of us, it's like our mouth is connected to the doorknob, like Larsine says. And she just kept on and on. Why did you drink so much? And, you know, why did you do this? And slow down, slow down, slow down. And, you know, in a little bit, the prayer would change. I wouldn't be praying for him to slow down. I'd just be praying for her to shut up. And that was just one of the things that happened on a regular basis. My dad's drinking. I don't know if he was drinking every day then, but I do know that from time to time, his drinking bothered me because it bothered her. I was very busy watching her to see what she was going to do, because she was watching him to see what he was going to do. And I started to school and ran around with some girls that I had gone to kindergarten with. And, you know, eventually it just became impossible for me to ask friends to come to my house, because the alcoholism was happening more and more. My dad's drinking was escalating, and my mom's, and I believe my mother was an untreated Al-Anon. I believe that she could have used Al-Anon desperately, but her disease was progressing too. I believe that we have a progressive disease on both sides, and that unless we do something about that, we don't have a very happy life. And as my dad continued to drink, the embarrassment and the shame that would happen for me is that I wouldn't want to bring my friends home. I always wanted to be somewhere else doing something else. As the alcoholism progressed, the physical violence began to start. And my mom and dad fought, and I would try to get up and get them to be separated and try to get my mother to come in one room and him to go in the other. You know, I knew what my dad wanted. My dad wanted to drink, and he wanted to come home, and he wanted to go to bed. And that was just something that my mother wasn't going to let him do. When he'd come in, she had a weapon that she used on him. I grew up in a town that had a little small hometown newspaper, and it was probably all of maybe two or three pages, but she'd roll that newspaper up real tight. And then she'd go after him, and she'd start hitting him with that newspaper. And pretty soon, he'd start hitting back. And many times, I watched my mother's face be sewed up in the emergency room from the blows of alcoholism. I know that alcoholism is a family disease. It affects everyone. It kills the people that don't even have it. Our disease kills us the same way that it kills the alcoholic. As time would go on, one of the things that I began to do is I watched them so much. I just always lived in fear, always waiting for that next shoe to drop, always trying to figure out, what am I going to do next? What am I going to do? What am I going to do? That seemed to be a reoccurring thing that was set in my head over and over and over again. What am I going to do? And when I was about 13 years old, my mother and dad, my mother decided she was going to leave, and she put me in the car and took me to Dallas to my grandmother's house. And, you know, even though I didn't want to live in that anger and the fighting and the alcoholism that was going on in my house, I didn't want to go live with my grandmother. I wanted my mother and daddy to stay together. And, you know, that was always the confusion for me. I'd want it one way, but I also would want it the other way, too. I just never could be figure out how to get this thing straightened out. And my mom came back to our house the next day, and she took me out of school, which was a really big deal for me. I felt embarrassed again because I was being taken out of school. And we went to our house to pack our bags, and I got on my bicycle and rode down to my dad's office. And, you know, I guess that was probably one of the first times that I wanted to tell an alcoholic what to do. And it worked. You know, he was at his office, and I went in, and I said, you know, Dad, you can't do this. You can't, your mother can't get a divorce, and I want you to go home, and I want you to do whatever it takes to make that all right. And he said, well, let's go have lunch. And I thought, uh-oh, I'm in trouble now. Nate, I'll tell you why I knew I was in trouble, because when my dad drank, he drank on a road in Dallas called Harry Huns, and I don't know if any of you are familiar with Dallas or familiar with Harry Huns, but it had a notorious reputation for having bars all up and down it. And, you know, if you're an Al-Anon of my mother's type, you've got to go look for him. And she'd put me in the car with her as a little bitty girl, and we'd go down on Harry Huns, driving from joint to joint to joint, looking for him. And sometimes we'd drive for an hour before we'd find his car because he moved around a lot. Go figure. And she'd find him, and she'd tell me to go in and get him. And this was the way it always was. I always was volunteered to go in and get him. I didn't know that that's what I was doing. But I'd go in, and he'd look at me walking in the door, and he'd say, come on over here. And he'd just be so excited to see me. And he'd put me up on that bar stool next to him, and he'd order me a Coke. And I mean, I thought I was as old as everybody else in that bar. I didn't think they realized I was like a 5 or 6 year old. And he'd introduce me to his friends around the bar, and I just felt like I was as big as they were. And we'd sit there, I don't know for how long, 10, 15 minutes, I guess. And then it would be time for him to go. I guess he didn't want to rush out and maybe it looked like that she'd sent me in to get him. But he'd take me off that bar stool, and we'd walk out of that bar together. And, oh, she would be blazing mad when we got out there. And he'd get in his car, and I'd say, can I go ride with Daddy? And she'd say, no, you have to ride with me. And you know, she'd do what we do. She fussed all the way home. She told me things that I didn't have any business knowing, and that's part of the disease of alcoholism, the family disease. I began to hear things that little children shouldn't have to listen to. And we'd get home, and the fight would start, and the newspaper would come out, and she'd hit him with that newspaper, and I would be up all night long. And I got where I, in school, I couldn't study. I couldn't stay awake. And so, you know, I'm resourceful. We're resilient. I began to cheat. You know, I had cheat sheets and cheat on my hand and every place that I could think of. And I'm sure that there's some teachers in here today, and I'm sure they recognize children like me. But I'm the one that sits in the back row, and I'm the one that nods off, and I'm the one that can't concentrate. And when you call on me, I don't even know what you've been talking about, because I was so worried about what was going to happen at home. I was so fearful that something would happen to my mother. I was always so afraid that he would kill her. The violence of alcoholism does kill. And I lived in that terror and that fear always. I got about 16 years old. They did go back together, by the way. She told him what she wanted. She didn't want him to ever bring alcohol in that house ever, ever again. Now, she did not say that he couldn't bring alcohol inside that house inside of him. You know, we try to pin you down, you alcoholics, and we try to make you extract promises from you, but I've learned that there's always a loophole, and he found that loophole. He never did bring a bottle of alcohol in that house again, but he did drink in bars all the time after that, so I saw very little of my dad, and when he came home, there was always a lot of chaos going on. But I was about 16, and I began to be asked out on dates, and I would turn down lots of dates because of the family disease of alcoholism. I was so afraid of what was going to happen if I would be gone. I was so afraid of what would happen if I went on a date and came home and he'd been drinking, because of the unpredictability of what would happen. Through high school, I just continued to cheat I learned to lie and to be deceitful with my friends. I always wanted to be at everybody else's house, and they all seemed so normal to me. You know, I look back on it now, and I don't know if those families were normal, but I do know this. The things that were going on at our house weren't going on at their house. So I stayed away a lot. I was real involved in school activities and liked to go to football games and was in organizations, and I so identified with Larsing. You know, I just didn't want my mother and dad to come up to any of the things that I was involved with because I felt embarrassed. And about the time I graduated from high school, and I look back on my life, and really the guys that I dated all seemed to have problems with alcohol. They all seemed to be the ones that had the reputation in school that drank a lot. And I got out of school that summer and was going off to North Texas to college in the fall, and a young man called me that I had grown up with. Now, we'd played together as young children. His family was friends with my family, and I just thought he was calling to ask me to go to the movie as a friend. I didn't have any idea that there was any other intentions there, and there may not have been. You know, but we went to the movie and we sat up in the balcony. And back in the olden days, the balcony was a big deal. And I was excited about that we were going to be sitting in the balcony. And I didn't know exactly what that was going to mean. But in a few minutes after the movie started, I found out because he reached over and took my hand. Now, if you're an Al-Anon of my type, you immediately size this up. He liked me. This wasn't just a friend. Friends don't hold hands. This, maybe there was something here. And there was. We started seeing each other exclusively after that. I don't think I dated anybody else, and I'm not sure if he did or didn't. But we started off to school in the fall, and I moved in the dorm, and he moved in his apartment. And it wasn't very long after that we got married and I got pregnant, and that was not the order that any of that happened in. And I moved in that dorm and absolutely was scared to death. I did not know what in the world I was going to do. And I certainly wasn't going to tell anybody that I was married. I don't know how I thought I wasn't going to be able to tell anybody that I was pregnant, but I wasn't going to do that either. And I was just perfectly content living in that dorm, and he was living in that apartment, and he did not see good reason for me to be in that dorm when I could be over at that apartment with him. But one Wednesday after school, after classes, he picked me up and he said, "We're going to Dallas today to tell your folks that we're married so that we can move in. You can move out of the dorm and move in with me." And I told him I didn't think that was a good idea because I didn't know what was going to happen when I went home. I didn't know. Everything in my life was planned around, you know, how much of the drinking was going on. You know, I began to, the disease of alcoholism has a look and a sound, and that was one of the things that I had done almost all my life was have to size the situation up, have to gauge when I was going to tell something or ask if I could do something. You never did just walk in and openly have a conversation about anything. Everything had to be measured out, figured out. Sometimes things never did get said because of what was going on, and I was just sure that this Wednesday was not the right day. And we got home, my mom was there, and she called my dad. He was at the office, and he came home. And my dad hadn't been drinking that day. And I absolutely loved my dad. He was a big barrel-chested guy, and he could do anything. And when I was with him and he wasn't drinking, I felt safe and I felt loved. And I have many, many good memories. He taught me how to shoot a gun, and he taught me how to ride horses. And he dug post holes, and I wanted to dig post holes with him. Almost anything that my dad did, I was always saying, can I do it? Let me help you. I want to help. And this day that he came home for me to tell him that we were married, he looked at me and he said, "Gal," that's what he called me, "Gal, I sure hope that you have enough sense to be married. And if you're an Al-Anon of my type, that's just a charge." You know, I just absolutely spent the next 10 years of my life proving to him that I had enough sense to be married. I'm telling you, I didn't have enough sense to be doing anything, but I thought I did. And I just picked that up, and I just carried it to my chest, and just we started out. And, you know, I can remember the years of being at home, and I always had this plan about what it was going to be like. You know, living in a fantasy world. I lived in a fantasy world where there's active alcoholism. The reality of that is too painful for me to look at. So I lived in a fantasy world, and I planned, and I thought about different places and what I was going to do. And one of the things that I knew was that I was never going to marry a man that drank like my dad, and I was certainly never going to act like my mother. I was going to be a good wife, and I was going to be a happy wife, and my husband was going to be happy to come home to me, and we were going to have fun, and we would have children, and we would have that white picket fence. And we absolutely got none of that. Almost from the get-go, it started. My mom had three things that she used to ask my dad all the time, and I just think this was so dumb. I don't know why she keeps asking him the same thing over and over again. He gives her the same answers. Why does she keep doing that? So he would come in and she'd say, "Where have you been? What have you been doing? And who have you been doing it with?" And my dad had never been anywhere, he'd never been doing anything, and he had never been with anybody. And you know, almost from the get-go, after I had moved in with Jerry, I was asking him the same things. I wanted to know where he'd been and what he'd been doing and who he'd been doing it with. And you know, I was pregnant and I was scared, and all those things just took over. It wasn't anything that I consciously decided to do. I was just doing them. My mouth was connected to the doorknob. You know, gripe and complain and fuss and try to get him to pay attention to me was all that I tried to do all the time. And pretty soon the violence started. And you know, when I was growing up and my dad and mother would have physical violence at the house, I would think, I'm never going to have that at my house, and certainly I'm never going to be the one that was hit. And you know, that really did happen. When the violence started with us, he wasn't the one that was violent. I was. I'd pick up anything. I'm so grateful that I didn't have a gun. I'm so grateful that nothing tragic happened in that, but we fought from one end of the house to the other all the time. And those children saw it too. We eventually had a little boy. You know, I thought I had it figured out. I knew what was wrong with him. He was just immature. I, on the other hand, was very mature. He was very immature. He had this little girl, and it just wasn't enough responsibility when she came. Maybe he needed another baby, and so without telling him, I quickly went to work on trying to have another baby, and I got pregnant a second time, and this little boy was born, and these children were the light of my life. I absolutely wanted to be the very best mother. I absolutely wanted to play with my children and have fun and have them love me as a mommy, and I believe that they did that, but I can tell you that I didn't have a clue about how to be a mom, and I was busy in the disease of alcoholism, watching and waiting and trying to figure out what I was going to do next. If he was going to come home, where was he? I was in the car driving around looking for him. One of the things that I decided that I did was going to do different was I wasn't going to send my children in. I wasn't going to hurt and harm my children the way I felt going in looking for my dad. I was not going to do that. So I'd put them in the car and we'd drive up and down roads. Times had changed and there were many, many other bars. It took me a lot longer to find him, I can tell you that. Dallas is a pretty big place when you're trying to find somebody. But I could do it. You know, if you check the credit card bills and you pay close attention, you can figure out where they are. And that's what we'd do. And, you know, I'd take them down to those bars and we'd pull in those dark parking lots. And, you know, I didn't send them in. I left them in the car. In the dark, dangerous car in a dark parking lot while I went in. And it really, I can't honestly tell you that I remember how long we stayed in there. It could have been 5 minutes or it could have been 20 minutes, but it never crossed my mind that my kids would have been afraid sitting out in that parking lot. And those fights would start. And many times he was in the emergency room having his face sewed up because of the disease of alcoholism. I would pick up anything and hit him with it. You know, am I proud of that? No. But it's where the disease of alcoholism had taken me, further and further down. I don't think that we ever go up until we get to some place where we can find recovery. But I just kept going further and further down. And I was too busy for those kids. He began to travel early on in that marriage, and I was with the children at home alone. And, you know, I had to call his room out of town over and over, and sometimes spent hours doing that with him on the phone or trying to figure out where he was and just ignoring my kids. You know, I was too busy. I was trying to figure out what was going to happen, telling them to go on, go play, and never even gave it a thought that it had any effect on them. We fought in front of them and never understood that that would have an effect on them either. And we were married for about 9 years, and he had been out of town and came home. One night I was over at a friend's house, and my children had gone home with my parents, and I was with she and her daughter, and I came home about 9 o'clock, and I walked in the house, and if you're an Al-Anon of my type, you kind of know if there's been someone in your house, if there's an ash in the ashtray that wasn't there before, or if the towel at the sink is a little bit mishung, or if there's a water glass in the kitchen sink, and all those things had been happening. And I walked in that house and walked back to our bedroom, and there was, all of those things were going on. There was a fragrance of cologne in the bathroom, and the towel had been moved. And I started for that front door because I thought someone was in that house. He was out of town. And just as I hit the front door, he came in the back door. And, you know, the fights that we had just started over, well, where were you going, is what he asked me. And the next question I asked him was, what are you doing here? And from those two questions, we unearthed everything that had ever happened with us. And we seemed to do that every time we got into it. We'd start off with one thing, and we would just unearth everything else. And we were fighting about everything that we'd ever fought about. We were just, you know, the quickest way to get out of the hole is to lay the shovel down. And we just kept taking that shovel and digging and digging and digging the hole deeper. And as that fight continued, I kept having pieces of my clothes. He was ripping pieces of my clothes off of me as we were fighting. And pretty soon I was naked. And he got up and left the room and walked back into our game room, and I heard him open a gun cabinet, and I stood listening, and I heard that shotgun break down, and I heard him put two shells in the cylinder, and I heard him click it shut. And I was standing at that kitchen cabinet, and I believe it was Mickey last night that was talking about the prayers that we say. I said, God, if you just get me out of this, I won't ever do this again. You know, those emergency prayers. And I hit that front door running and ran in as far as I could, naked, down the street, and hopped into a flower bed of a neighbor's of ours. And I laid in that flower bed watching him stalk back and forth with that gun. I think that if he had found me that night, you'd have another speaker today, because there was so much rage and so much anger and so much violence going on in our lives that we didn't have sound thinking anymore. And, you know, this is alcoholism. I called my aunt and uncle, and they came and picked me up the next day and filed for divorce. And 2 weeks later, we're sitting in the attorney's office, him with his attorney, me with mine, and I did the thing that I did over and over. I sold myself out. I gave away all my dignity and my self-respect piece by piece throughout the years with alcoholism. He shoved a gold coin over across the table to me, and he said the magic words. You all know what they are. Oh, baby, oh, baby, oh, baby, I love you. We've got two beautiful children, and we can put this together. And, you know, I walked out of that lawyer's office, and we went back together, and that was all that was ever said about that whole situation, you know, just sweeping it under the carpet. And we were together for another year, and, you know, I knew that there were other women in his life, and that began to be something that I did too. When you let your dignity slip away and you let any principles that you've ever had slip away, I began to do just anything and everything. And I met a young man that was taking his children to school, and it wasn't very long until he and I were seeing each other, and before the year's end was out, we were separated and started on a divorce. And, you know, I just had this feeling that I had missed it all. And I just hit the streets running. And I wish that I could tell you that I took a course at one of the local colleges, or maybe took basket weaving or something. I did take a knitting course one time, but they kicked me out because my language was too foul. You know, that's another thing. When I got here to you, I had the dirtiest mouth you would ever want to hear, ever. And I hope that it'll come out about how that all cleaned up. But I was sitting over in Fort Worth and down at the Colonial Golf Tournament and down in the bar. Where else would I be? And I looked over, and there was this incredibly looking guy sitting across the room. Now, I like bad boys and pretty packages. And there he was. He had a long-legged blonde sitting on his lap. And I thought that was just about the trashiest thing I'd ever seen at the country club. Probably the only thing trashy about it wasn't me. And we started that little electrical thing, you know, that we do, the little thing with the eyes where the electricity starts and the little tension that builds. And he said, I want your phone number. And I said, no. Guys like you are too much trouble. And he persisted. And he finally asked my friend for my phone number. And then, of course, we played the little game, give me my phone number back. You can't have my phone number. I'm not going out with you. Guys like you are too much trouble. And before the night was over, I had said, well, if you're so interested, why don't we go out tonight? And he said, no, I have a date. I had a date. I would have broken my date for him. I can tell you that in a heartbeat. But he said to me something that just hooked me. He said, I have a date, and I wouldn't break a date with her for you. and I wouldn't break a date with you for someone else. And I thought, he has character. Little did I know, he was a character. He is a character. And we had a date the next day. And come November, it'll be 27 years. But that has not all been easy, and we certainly were a long way for recovery. He and I did one of the things that I was doing on a pretty regular basis. He moved right in. He says it took several weeks. I think it was probably less than a week. I just wanted somebody there. I just needed someone else. I didn't worry about how it affected my children. I didn't worry about how it was affecting me, and I certainly didn't worry about how it was affecting my family. You know, I was one of those that got to you saying, everything I did didn't hurt anybody but me. And I can tell you today, through working those steps and going to meetings and having a sponsor and taking direction and doing the things that I've watched people lay out in front of me to do, I hurt everybody around me. I hurt my parents. I broke their heart. I was their daughter. And I went places and did things that they never wanted their daughter to do. And my children were right there watching the disease of alcoholism exactly the way I was growing up. And I never even realized the people that I hurt. But this man moved in with me, and my dad had a garden. And he brought a box of vegetables to put on my front porch one day, and it said decay in question mark. And, you know, I know that he knew what was going on, and I know the kind of pain that caused him. He had three kids. Joe had three kids, and I had two. To say that either one of us had a clue about how to be a parent would have been an understatement, to say the very least. We just knew that we were going to do it different than the way we had done it before. And we just took those five kids and shuffled them together like two decks of cards, and everything was going to be wonderful. And we did have a lot of good times with the kids. We did spend a lot of time, but alcoholism had already bloomed, and I didn't know it in Joe, and it was blooming right before my very eyes, almost from the get-go. The kids started drinking. They were 13, 12, 11, 10, and 5 years old. So they were all close together, and the older ones had started to drink, and I didn't even know that. My daughter told me later, since recovery, that she got drunk the first time when she was 11 years old, and the magic started for her. She couldn't wait till she did it again. And I didn't have any idea at the time, but I did know later on because they were getting into trouble. You know, Joe and I were gone a lot. Where that first husband was gone all the time, and this husband wanted to take me with him every place he went. And boy, I was ready to go. If he said, let's go, I was in the car. We traveled a lot, and we left those kids. I'd like to tell you that we left them with people. Sometimes we just left them alone, never thinking that they were going to get into any kind of trouble, I guess. We were so selfish and so into what we were doing. I was so glad to get to be with Joe that I just would leave and go anywhere and come in at any time. My idea of an evening would be to give them all some money and tell them to go get something to eat, and they'd see us when they saw us coming back. Our kids got into a lot of trouble during those years because of my neglect in watching them. They were in trouble with the law. They were in trouble with school. They began to wreck cars. I don't know if you've experienced that. Insurance goes up when they wreck cars, I can tell you. And I'm the one that was always fixing them. My kids told me later that I was their chief enabler, and you know, I didn't have a clue at the time what that meant when we first came into Al-Anon, but I've certainly come to understand that now. Almost any trouble they got into, I was ready to get them out of. I'd call school. I'd fix their cars. I would make excuses at jobs that they had. I was always screaming and yelling at them for everything that they ever did, but absolutely feeling like King Kong when I could solve all their problems. But the problems kept getting bigger. One time, three of them were down on the bridge close to our house on the toll road and dropped a water balloon off the top of it and broke a window out of a classic car. It scared us to death. It could have been a horrible accident. It could have killed the person that was in it, but it didn't, and we only had to replace the window on that car. It was not cheap. It was like a Dodge Dart or something. I didn't know they were classic cars. And the police took them in, and, you know, I would get them out. If they got put in jail, I'd go get them out. Joe would say, no, we're going to leave them. And I'd say, no, we're not. No kid of mine is going to stay in jail, and we'd go get them out. And they would get kicked out of school. One time we got a call from the school, and they said that, could we come get Kevin? He'd tried to burn the school down. And, you know, they'd leave school all the time, and it was just always something going on. And I was so busy trying to keep up with them and trying to keep them all where they were supposed to be. And Joe just sat and drank. I was driving carpools and chasing after them and trying to fix all of the problems that was going on with the kids, and never even knew that alcoholism was blooming. And somewhere before November was blank. So I just put it in my pocket, and I called my husband and I said, come home, we've got to go see about your sister. Now, what's he going to do? It's his sister, right? So here we go. And I called a friend of mine who's a doctor and got all the scoop on what the doctor thought should be going on, and I called my friend who's a psychiatrist and got all the scoop on what he thought, and I also called the lawyer and got all the scoop on what the legal situation was. And I had a legal pad, and I was going to go interview these doctors. And you know, one of the very first miracles that ever happened in my life happened before I came to the program. I walked in the room in that hospital in Jackson, and I took a look at that sister-in-law, and for the first time in my life, I didn't know what to do. I didn't have an answer. All that stuff written on the piece of paper went out the window, because what I saw was my beautiful sister-in-law, bloated and swollen and yellow and shaking. Not only did I not recognize her, but she didn't recognize me. And I just didn't know what to do. And I came out of her room, and my husband and I talked a few minutes, and I said, I'm going to go call your sister, Glenda. Now, Glenda was in AA. Glenda and Wally had been in AA for about 5 years at this time. Oh, God, were we glad they were in AA in Illinois. They were bad. And we thought y'all were a cult. And we were glad. We were glad that y'all were a cult, and we were glad that y'all had them. If we had done the things that they did, well, we might have to, too. We didn't think you all were too much fun before we got here. But I called Glenda and I told her what I saw, and I said, Glenda, I don't know what to do. I said, you know, I don't know how to help Jeannie. And she said, oh, I do. I said, you do? She said, yeah, Jeannie's alcoholic and she's being treated for the wrong thing. And I said, I don't know about that. And that was the truth. I didn't know about alcoholism. I did know a lot about drinking, but not about alcoholism. And I said, can you come? And she did. She got on the plane. She flew from Austin to Jackson. And she got off. She had a hanging bag, had 300 pounds of AA books and one dress. The second miracle that happened for me before I came to you was this beautiful sister-in-law of mine that was in the AA program began the process of 12-stepping me. The hand of AA was there when I reached out. And over the next several days, Glenda shared her life story, and she talked about recovery. I didn't know what she was talking about, but I asked her lots of questions, and we slept very little, and the miracle began to happen for me. A couple of days later, we took that sister-in-law against medical advice out of that hospital with the doctor screaming, she's going to die, you're going to kill her. And she went to a facility for drugs and alcohol, a treatment center, and that sister-in-law has been sober. She's had bouts where she's had slips in sobriety, but she has been sober almost this last 15 years. And I got a phone call while we were up there from my oldest daughter, who was blazing mad. And she said, what in the world are you doing? And you should be home helping me. And I said, I think for the first time I kind of have an idea about what could be going on with us. And when we get back to Dallas, we'll see what we can do. And in the next 10 days, I had gone to Austin and picked her up, and we brought her back to Dallas, and over the next 10 days, two of our other children, so we had three children in treatment within 10 days. And, you know, I had started going to meetings that very first night that we got back to Dallas. That sister-in-law took me to a meeting over at Preston, and there was a beautiful woman standing behind that podium named Vesta. And I didn't hear a word that Vesta said, but I could see. And she looked calm, and she was dressed beautifully. And she just spoke about the disease of alcoholism and her love for the alcoholic and what she had done in her journey through Al-Anon. And I heard one thing that she said that night, self-will run riot. I can't imagine why that fit me like a glove. But it absolutely, didn't know a thing about it, but it fit me like a glove. And I've come to learn that I had lived my whole life in self-will and certainly was running riot all over everything. And it started for me. I began to talk to that sister-in-law every day because I was coming out of my skin. I went to 1 to 3 meetings a day. I heard him say 90 meetings in 90 days, kind of like Mickey, I'll show him. I'll go to 90 meetings in 90 days too. And I was going from 1 to 3 meetings a day. I absolutely could not stay in my skin. It felt like I was raw on the outside. And sitting in the meetings was the only place that I could breathe in and out. And the minute the meeting was over and I'd be gone, I'd be looking for another meeting somewhere else to go to. And over the next several months, that's what happened. Talked to that sister-in-law on a regular basis every single day, and she'd say, did you get a sponsor today? Did you go to a meeting today? Well, I went to a meeting, but I didn't get a sponsor. And in February of 97, actually in January of 87, I was over at a group, and a lady walked over to me and said, have you heard that black-headed lady across the room? And I said no, and so I walked over and introduced myself, and she was going to be doing steps someplace, and the next month I went over and listened to her, and, you know, it was like everything that she said just nailed me. I just understood. And at the end of that month, I asked her to sponsor me, and, you know, my life began to change. Those kids all got out of treatment, and they've done various things. They haven't stayed, but I've stayed because the disease of alcoholism has affected me, and I won't ever get well. I'll always need Al-Anon. I started going to meetings and got that sponsor, and you know, she put me in those steps immediately, those 12 steps that Alcoholics Anonymous gave us. She had me read the big book, and she had me change the word from alcoholic to Al-Anon, where that says drink or drunk to control or think. And I mean, it just fit me like a T. I began to understand. She told me to go to 2 Al-Anon meetings. Now, I was going to many more Al-Anon meetings, and I was sure she'd made a mistake, that wouldn't be enough for me. But it's been proven that it's been just enough for me. I do go to more than that sometimes, but regularly I go to 2 Al-Anon meetings every week, and I open AA. A lot of my recovery has been sitting in the open AA meetings because I don't understand alcoholics. I don't understand how they think. I don't understand what they do. But in sitting there, I have been able to learn a lot about the disease of alcoholism, and I'm so grateful for that. I started working those steps, and you know, I had things that I was going to take to my grave, but I ended up writing every one of those things down. She talked about the wormy stuff. You know, did you have any wormy stuff? And I had lots of wormy stuff, things that I didn't want anybody to know, but it said that an honest inventory, and so I began to write all that down, all the shame. I walked out of that house that I grew up in when I was 18 years old, and I slammed that door, and I would have said that did not affect me not one bit if it hadn't been for you. But I wrote all that stuff down on the paper, and I wrote about how I was in my marriages and how I was with when I was raising my kids, and the miracle of Al-Anon began to happen, and those things began to heal. We talked about a power greater than ourselves. I walked in the door. I turned away from any God that I had ever known and was godless when I got here. I don't know that I didn't believe in God. I believed that there was a God, but that he just didn't have time for me. And I didn't know that God forgave. All I had to do was ask him. And that journey of a relationship with a higher power began. In that second step where it says a power greater than yourself, I said, there better be. There better be a power greater than me, because if there's not, I'm dead. And I began to do those simple things like pray on my knees and work those steps and go to meetings. And I began to take commitments. The very first commitment I ever took was a literature commitment. And, you know, I wanted to be the best literature person that group had ever had. But it gave me so much to be able to be a part of that group. And I've been in service ever since. I began to sponsor others in the program. And what a joy that is to see the dark eyes that we have when we come in and the lights come on. I don't think that there's any greater gift than that. And my family, through working those steps, and I mean all 12 of them, and I've worked them in order, doing that fifth step and taking the sixth and seventh, and separates the men from the boys or the women from the girls, and writing that eight-step list and then going and making those nine-step amends. I've made all my nine-step amends, and I continue to clean up every single day. Well, maybe it might happen the next day, but I'm making amends for my behavior as I go along. And you know, the miracle of that is that I sat down with each one of my children and made amends to them. And I have relationships with them all. I see them all. They don't all live around Dallas anymore. But they come and we go to their house and we talk on the phone and we have a good time together. Our family is healing. My parents were deceased by the time I got here, but you all gave me a way to clean all that up too. I know that my dad didn't wake up one morning and decide that he wanted to be an alcoholic. And I know that my mother didn't want to do and act the ways that she did. And as that disease progressed through my family, I realized that we have an illness that can be arrested. And we've been given a way of life that I never dreamed possible. My life is a gift from God. And what I do with that life is my gift to Him. Thank you very much.